own. The subject we're going to deal with now deserves a whole shelf of books. In fact, there are so many examples of this particular atheist characteristic that it has been a Herculean task to cut this chapter down to a manageable size. Of course, the trait I'm referring to is intellectual shallowness. The fact is, there are only so many ignorant taunts that can be made by atheist celebrities. There are only so many arrogant lies that can be told by atheist authors. There are only so many ruthless murders that can be committed by atheist dictators. But there is simply no end to the number of idiotic statements that can come out of atheist mouths. I really don't mean to be facetious here. The famed attorney, Vincent Bugliosi, who prosecuted Charles Manson, was one of the most successful trial lawyers of all time. And even though he was an agnostic, he painstakingly analyzed the works of the three most influential new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens. After finishing his research, he came to the conclusion that all of their arguments were empty, illogical, and embarrassingly superficial. In his book, Divinity of Doubt, he said, quote, "In my various investigations throughout my career, I have found that if you start out with a valid premise, not an ultimate conclusion, virtually everything you discover thereafter falls into place. In this case, because the core belief of these three atheist authors was so intrinsically unsound, they could not present any solid evidence or even make any persuasive arguments for the proposition that there is no God." End quote. Atheism, he determined, is really nothing but a sorry litany of non sequiturs. Now, non sequitur is a Latin phrase that means does not follow. The dictionary defines it as an invalid argument in which the conclusion does not logically follow from the statements or premises that come before it. For example, John Smith does not own a car. Therefore, John Smith is poor. Anyone with even the slightest modicum of intelligence can see that such a statement makes no sense. It may be true that John Smith is poor, but that fact cannot be proven just because he doesn't own a car. Perhaps John leases a car. Perhaps John is only 10 years old and too young to buy a car. Perhaps he lives in the city and takes public transportation everywhere and doesn't need a car. Perhaps he is actually very rich and able to hire a limousine and driver. Perhaps he is rich, but he's in prison for tax evasion. Perhaps he has a phobia about driving. There are many legitimate reasons why this individual named John might not possess an automobile. And yet, there are some silly people out there who would presume that John must be poor. To them, a lack of funds is the only possible explanation for his situation. What can you say about such people? Is it really cruel to conclude that they are shallow or superficial or stupid? And here again, we come to the perfect picture of a modern-day atheist. Their reasoning, if you can call it that, is made up almost exclusively of logical fallacies such as the non sequitur. They write books full of scathing attacks on God and religion that in the end prove absolutely nothing because their arguments are the most flimsy and shallow kind imaginable. And the flimsiest and shallowest of them all is something called the straw man argument. The straw man argument is a technique wherein someone oversimplifies, overstates, or misrepresents his opponent's position so that it's more easily refuted. He basically creates a phony straw man for the sole purpose of knocking it down and claiming victory. Atheists love this type of argument and use it all the time. For instance, they're always making the claim that the Bible disproves the existence of God. They say, if the Bible is really a true book, as you Christians believe, then God obviously doesn't exist, because the Bible is full of lies, errors, and contradictions. In other words, they first misrepresent the Bible by overgeneralizing it, saying that it's simply true. Then they discredit this straw man misrepresentation. And finally, they conclude that they have refuted God himself. Voila! Only that doesn't work. It's a completely false line of thinking. Not only is it illogical and invalid, but it's also extraordinarily shallow, not to mention intellectually dishonest. First of all, even if you could prove that the Bible was full of errors, doing so would not prove that God doesn't exist. Millions of people all over the world believe in God, but don't accept the Bible as true. Disproving the Bible might call into question some aspects of certain religions, but it would not call into question the existence of God. The two propositions, the Bible's accuracy and the reality of God, are not logically connected. To attack the Bible, as so many atheists do in order to bolster their case against God, is simply a non sequitur. It's like saying, John Smith doesn't own a car, therefore John Smith is poor. Besides being illogical, the atheist's criticism of the Bible is profoundly superficial in other ways. For example, they make no distinction between literal truth and metaphoric truth. They frequently cite certain passages in Scripture that seem far-fetched to them, such as the story of Jonah being swallowed by a big fish, and then unleash a fury of ridicule. "This is just too preposterous for words," they laugh. "How could a whale or fish swallow a whole man? How could a man survive in a whale's stomach for 3 days? It's scientifically impossible. He would have been digested. The story is obviously a myth on the same level as the tooth fairy. Therefore, the Bible is false and anyone who believes it is a lunatic." And so on. Now, for goodness sake, how shallow is this line of thinking? It makes at least two invalid assumptions. One, that supernatural events are simply impossible. And two, that the story of Jonah must be taken literally. In the first instance, the assumption that this event couldn't take place is not something that could be proven empirically. It's not even logical. After all, if God exists, why shouldn't he be able to suspend the natural laws? He created those laws in the first place. To simply assume he can't is an example of circular reasoning. This particular miraculous event didn't happen because miracles themselves don't happen. The second assumption is that the book of Jonah must be read literally. But that is not how all Christians and Jews approach this story or how they approach the Bible generally. Though some Christians do adhere to a strictly literal interpretation of even this Bible text on the grounds just stated that God can perform any kind of supernatural miracle he wishes, most Christians take a much wider and deeper view of Scripture. Christian doctrine holds that the Bible is not just one book, but a collection of books written at different times in history and in different literary styles. It's true that the author of all Scripture is God, but God used many different people as instruments to write down his words over the course of the centuries, and those people employed many different literary techniques. As Bishop Robert Barron has said so well in his popular YouTube videos, the Bible is more like a library than one single book. Now, if you walk into a library and ask a librarian, "Should I take everything in this building literally?" you won't receive a blanket yes or no answer. The librarian would be much more nuanced and say something like, "Well, there are many sections in this library. If you go over to the science or history departments, then you'll certainly find that they're filled with historical facts. However, if you go over to the fiction and poetry sections, you'll find a tremendous amount of very deep and rich truth conveyed through narrative, metaphors, and powerful imagery rather than literal facts." Now that would be an intelligent answer, and you'd have to be a relatively intelligent person to understand it. You couldn't be a silly or superficial thinker. Something similar can be said about understanding the Bible. According to believers, the Bible is the inerrant and infallible Word of God. Unlike the information contained in an average library, all the information in the Bible is true. But that doesn't mean that it's all true in the same way. If you read the section of the Bible known as the Gospels, then yes, you're going to be dealing mainly with historical facts, eyewitness accounts of events that really, truly happened in the life of Jesus. If you go to the book of Genesis, however, you're going to find stories that are every bit as true, but are more allegorical in nature. An allegory is a story or poem that contains a hidden meaning, usually a moral or religious truth. Thus, the meaning of the story of Jonah and the whale is that if you want to run away from God, as Jonah did, you'll be swallowed up in darkness. Yet even in the depths and bowels of a darkness that seems overwhelming, there's always hope that you might once again see the light of day. Because as long as you turn back to God, you always have access to forgiveness and salvation. That is the truth contained in the story, and it is a very great truth. When atheists ridicule the book of Jonah as a moronic myth, they don't prove that the Bible is wrong, that believers are gullible, or that God doesn't exist. All they prove is that they are too shallow and slow-witted to understand more sophisticated ways of reading. Of course, the story of Jonah goes even deeper than this. Jonah was also a prophet who prefigured Jesus Christ. According to the Gospels, Christ suffered a brutal execution and was entombed in the earth for 3 days before rising from the dead. By his death and resurrection, Christ showed that even the greatest evil, the murder of God, could be overcome and transformed into the greatest good, the gift of eternal life in heaven. Thus, the story of Jonah's captivity in the belly of the fish for 3 days and his subsequent release foreshadowed Christ's burial in the tomb and final victory over death and helped prepare mankind to receive the most important of all religious messages. Jesus himself read the story of Jonah in this way. Read the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 12. The idea being conveyed in the biblical account of Jonah is therefore very profound. You can reject it if you like, but you certainly can't pretend it's not a weighty theological concept. And yet, that's exactly what atheists do. They read the story of Jonah through a ridiculously narrow lens, discredit the book as scientifically impossible, and then conclude with a colossal non sequitur. Because the Bible is false, therefore God himself is a mere human fabrication. Absurd. They do the same thing when it comes to religion. As we heard in chapter 3, atheists make the preposterous claim that religion is the worst enemy of mankind, that it's responsible for most of history's murder and bloodshed. They point out all the bad deeds committed by religious people over the centuries, vices, cruelties, stupidities, hypocrisies, and then conclude not only that religion is evil, but also that belief in God is unreasonable. In other words, they slay the dragon of organized religion and then announce that they have slain God too. That's the whole premise of Christopher Hitchens' best-selling book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. But Hitchens' book isn't a logical argument against God. It's simply a diatribe against religion and religious people. The very title contains a glaring non sequitur. For even if it were true that religion poisons everything, it certainly doesn't follow that God is not great or that he doesn't exist. Just as millions of people in the world don't accept the Bible, millions of people in the world don't subscribe to the tenets of any organized religion, and yet still believe in a personal creator. Or take another example. The book that you're listening to right now is all about atheism. We've given dozens of examples that demonstrate the arrogance, ignorance, ruthlessness, intolerance, and shallowness of these unbelievers. But have we once claimed to disprove the atheist position? Have we once made the assertion that because atheists are arrogant, there must, therefore, be a God? Of course not. All we've done is show that atheists themselves are ignorant, ruthless, imbecilic, etc. We wouldn't argue that this somehow proves the Bible, Christianity, or theism to be true. If we did, we'd be committing the same kind of logical fallacy as the atheists. We'd be just as shallow as them. And we're not. Beyond this obvious non sequitur, atheists haven't even been remotely successful in slaying the dragon of organized religion. As we've discussed, they've had to place huge blinders over their eyes in order to avoid seeing all the good that religion has done throughout history. They've essentially had to force themselves not to recognize the extraordinary contributions to civilization religion has made to culture, politics, education, and the arts. G.K. Chesterton once said, quote, "The abuses which are supposed to belong especially to religion belong to all human institutions. They are not the sins of supernaturalism, but the sins of nature. When people impute special vices to the Christian church, they seem entirely to forget that the world has these vices much more. The church has been cruel, but the world has been much more cruel. The church has plotted, but the world has plotted much more. The church has been superstitious, but it has never been so superstitious as the world when left to itself. End quote. The bottom line is that cataloging the bad behavior of believers doesn't prove anything, except perhaps the bad behavior of humanity. It certainly doesn't prove that religion itself is bad, and it doesn't go anywhere near proving that believing in God is bad. Can you imagine if someone tried to make the same argument against science? What if someone said that scientific study should be outlawed because it was harmful to mankind? After all, the history of science hasn't been so spotless. Everyone has heard stories about evil Nazi doctors who conducted unspeakable medical experiments on Jewish children in order to advance the scientific cause. Just think about all the detrimental effects science has had over the course of the last 100 years, and the potential harm it might do in the future. Remember, science has given us the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb. It's given us ballistic missiles and thousands of other weapons of mass destruction. Science has given us the hideous ability to wipe out the entire population of the earth by pressing a few buttons. It's given us the ability to commit the most ferocious acts of terrorism, the most heinous crimes, and inflict the most intense suffering imaginable. But would it be fair to say that because of its destructive potential, science itself is bad? Or that it should be banned? Or that we should ignore the tremendous good that it's done? How ludicrous would such conclusions be? Yet, that's exactly the kind of argument that atheists use against religion. We could go on and on. Another laughable argument advanced by atheists is that the theory of evolution disproves God's existence. Evolution, of course, is the process by which organisms change over time as a result of the various physical and behavioral traits that have been passed on from generation to generation because of their ability to aid in the survival of the species. Atheists think that this theory somehow explains the mystery of life. They essentially assert that since bacteria evolved into Beethoven and microbes mutated into Mozart, the universe has no creator. The world itself, they say, is responsible for its own animate life forms. But once again, this is a blatant non sequitur. Assuming that evolution is true, and remember, it's still very much a theory, there is no evidence to suggest that God did not originally create life on this planet and then allow evolution to develop life further. Evolution does not in any way account for how life began or why. All it explains is how life might have changed. In other words, evolution is a process of operation. It has nothing to do with origination. Michael Poole, in his excellent little book on the New Atheists, illustrates this crucial distinction with an example. If you were alone in your home and noticed that a light in the next room suddenly came on, you might naturally ask yourself, who did that? You might wonder if your spouse had turned on the light, or maybe your child, or maybe even an intruder. All these would be plausible explanations. But if you asked an electrician the question, why did the light go on, and this particular electrician didn't possess too much common sense, he might respond by saying, quote, the reason the light went on is because an electric current flowing at low pressure transferred energy to the ionized gases in the light bulb, which raised their atoms to a higher energy orbit and then back down again, causing them to re-emit their energy in the form of radiation, which in turn excited the phosphor coating on the inside of the tube in the bulb, thereby causing it to emit light. End quote. Now, what did the electrician do? Did he answer the question, who turned on the light? Or did he actually answer the question, what is the scientific process by which light is emitted? That is exactly what shallow-thinking atheists do when they claim that evolution disproves God. They use long scientific descriptions to explain the mechanism by which they think life developed, and then jump to the irrational conclusion that they have explained the cause of life itself. In philosophical terms, they confuse process with agency. Indeed, atheists not only misunderstand evolution, they also misunderstand the whole mental discipline of science. They seem to have no grasp whatsoever of what scientific study actually entails. If they ever bothered to consult a dictionary, they would find that science deals with events, objects, and phenomena that take place within the empirically measurable and observable universe. And that's all. Philosophy and religion, on the other hand, deal with first and ultimate causes. Now, teenagers who are enraptured with scientific technology and haven't given much thought yet to the deeper metaphysical questions of life can be excused for thinking that science explains where the universe came from. But adult atheists who write extremely hostile books composed of sweeping and childish pronouncements cannot be excused. In fact, the most idiotic atheistic claim in the world is that there has never been any scientific evidence discovered for God's existence. Well, of course there hasn't. What kind of evidence are they expecting to find? An enormous fingerprint on the planet Saturn made eons ago by one of the Almighty's divine digits? Come on! No rational believer thinks God is one of the observable objects within his own creation. If there is a God who made the universe, then he certainly stands apart from that universe. He is certainly radically different from that universe. Like any creator, he must necessarily be outside of his creation. If, for the sake of argument, all the fictional characters in Hamlet could magically come together and perform a series of scientific experiments, would they ever be able to locate William Shakespeare within the country of Denmark or anywhere else in the pages of that play? If all the figures of the Night Watch decided to scientifically investigate every cubic centimeter of the canvas they're painted on, would they ever discover Rembrandt? If all the ingredients in a chocolate layer cake could somehow conduct an empirical test on all the other ingredients of that cake, would they ever be able to find the baker? This is the same kind of thinking employed by atheists when they challenge believers to produce scientific evidence for God's existence. It makes no sense. It's a non sequitur. Another phony straw man. There's plenty of rational evidence to show that God created the universe, but that evidence is not scientific in nature. Atheists can't seem to grasp the elementary distinction between these two different kinds of knowing. They don't have a handle on either the limits of science or the deeper question of how science fits into the overall scheme of human knowledge. This is a very serious intellectual handicap. In fact, it even has a name. It's called scientism, and it means the reduction of all legitimate knowledge to the scientific form of knowledge. Every major atheist writer today has fallen under the delusional spell of scientism. And so have their legion of robotic disciples. They all make the same excessive and asinine claim. If science can't prove it, then it's not real. But is that true? Is the only kind of reality scientific reality? What about the reality of love, or happiness, or tragedy, or hope? What about the reality of literature? Or music, or art? What about the reality of common sense or intuition? What about the reality of history or reliable testimony? What about the reality of the whole world of the spirit? Are all of these fake or non-existent? The truth is, certain things in life can't be scientifically ascertained. As we said previously, science cannot, has not, and will not ever be able to answer questions such as, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there life rather than lifelessness? Why is there thought rather than thoughtlessness? These questions cannot be answered by science for the simple reason that they are not scientific questions to begin with. They are philosophic questions. So it's impossible to use the scientific method to deal with them. impossible to apply empirical observation to them, impossible to perform experiments on them. Science isn't applicable in these cases, just as it isn't applicable when trying to prove or disprove truths about art, literature, music, poetry, and love. Again, this is a deeper form of thinking, and one that atheists hardly ever engage in. They don't ask themselves, what are the different kinds of truth knowable by human beings, and does the concept of God fall into one of those categories? Instead, they're content to repeat the same old sorry litany of non sequiturs. The Bible disproves God's existence. Religion disproves God's existence. Evolution disproves God's existence. Science disproves God's existence. The complexity of the universe disproves God's existence. Unanswered prayer disproves God's existence. The large number of intellectuals who are atheists disprove God's existence. The desire for heaven disproves God's existence. The concept of hell disproves God's existence. Suffering disproves God's existence. But none of these assertions disproves anything. All can be answered rationally and logically. But in order to do that, we must demonstrate not only why they are illogical, but also why the very terms atheists use are incorrect misrepresentations, why they're just phony strawman arguments. For instance, when atheists say that the Christian concept of hell is so horrible that no one could possibly believe it, the first thing one must do is correct their cartoonish idea of hell. When atheists say that the biblical concept of God is so cruel that no one could possibly accept it, the first thing one must do is correct their naive notion of God. When atheists say that the large number of unanswered prayers in the world make it foolish for anyone to pray, the first thing one must do is correct their childish understanding of prayer. This takes time. It takes thought. It takes work. And unfortunately, atheists aren't willing to put in the intellectual effort necessary to argue on this level. Instead, they prefer to waste their time squabbling over irrelevancies. The question is, why? Why won't they deal honestly with the real philosophical and theological arguments for God's existence? Why don't they address, for example, the question of efficient causality, the first uncaused cause? Why don't they address the question of infinite contingencies? Whether or not the cosmos must exist? Why don't they address the question of the intelligibility of the universe? Why don't they address the question of free will and the human soul? Why don't they address the question of intelligent design, which they always dismiss without actually answering? We'll be talking about some of these things later on, but the point now is to understand that atheists have utterly failed to engage in a vigorous intellectual discussion about these topics. In fact, most of the angry unbelievers who write their angry books and blogs aren't even able to comprehend these matters, much less debate them. All they seem to care about is knocking down straw men. What could be their reason? The answer, I'm afraid, lies in the fact that straw men are easy opponents. Straw men don't have brains. They don't argue back. They don't point out logical fallacies and non sequiturs. They don't attempt to fight at all, which is exactly why atheists love them so much. At heart, atheists are nothing but dim-witted bullies, and all bullies, deep down, are cowards who are afraid to fight anyone their own size. But that's a subject we'll be dealing with in our next chapter, the massive yellow streak going straight down the back of the modern atheist movement. Chapter 6. The Cowardice of the Atheists. There's a spiritual law that applies in a particularly powerful way to the atheists we've been talking about in this book. It can't be proven scientifically, of course, but it is true nonetheless. And the law is this: you can't practice vice virtuously. If you're engaged in some kind of habitual vice in one area of your life, then sure as the sun rises each day, you're going to be practicing some kind of vice in another area as well. It's possible to compartmentalize your personal and business lives in many different ways, but not when it comes to morality, at least not for long. If, for example, you are a habitual thief, then it's safe to assume that you're not going to be a very faithful person either. If you're a habitual philanderer, then chances are you're not going to be very honest. If you're a habitual liar, then you're not going to be very wise. It's just a ridiculous Hollywood fantasy to think that someone who sells drugs for a living is also going to be a model citizen and demonstrate heroic virtue in his personal life, or that a person who works in the pornography industry is going to be a loving, honest, adoring, and faithful spouse. It's just not possible over the long term. Pride, gluttony, lust, laziness, lying, and all the other vices are mysteriously connected, just as the virtues are mysteriously connected. Everything is wired together in some way. People who believe in God might explain this phenomenon in two ways. They might tell you poetically that when you turn away from the light, you'll naturally find yourself engulfed in darkness. When you turn away from the good, you'll naturally leave behind all that is good. From a theological perspective, they might alternatively say that when you engage in habitual vice, you are actually working to erode your willpower. Ultimately, your willpower gives you the strength to do good and avoid evil. Therefore, if you habitually give in to one particular vice, then your diminishing willpower will no longer be strong and effective enough to battle other vices either. When your willpower is weakened, you basically lose control everywhere in life. You darken the intellect so that it can't see what's right. You disable the body so it can't fight temptation. You de-energize and immobilize everything. It's like moving your left leg in one direction and your right leg in the other. When you do that, you're not going to be able to go anywhere. You're going to be stuck in the same position. Or if you're driving in your car and you try to step on the gas with one foot and the brake with the other, you're going to come to a screeching halt and probably damage your vehicle too. The bottom line is, your moral behavior in one area affects your moral behavior in another area. If you get stuck in the groove of doing something bad, you'll eventually be doing other bad things as well. You can't practice vice virtuously. Enter our friends, the atheists. It's no accident that these folks seem to be so bad in so many different ways. It's not just that they've made a mistake in one area, or that they happen to be wrong about one particular question. If that were the case, then all we would have to do is engage in friendly debate. But atheists are not just incorrect in their reasoning about God. As a group, we've already shown them to be arrogant, ignorant, deceptive, ruthless, intolerant, unforgiving, unrelenting, and extraordinarily foolish. And we're only halfway through this book. When people carry on in such a toxic way for so long, their character traits become quite predictable. It's not difficult to conclude that they'll generally be rude, bullying, and boorish across the whole spectrum of social behavior. In the previous chapter, for instance, we discussed how atheists love to fight straw men because straw men can't fight back. This fact is explained by a powerful vice that atheists constantly exhibit: intellectual and physical cowardice. For example, everyone agrees that Christopher Hitchens was one of the foremost atheists of modern times. An excellent writer as well as a funny and quick-witted debater, he was considered a hero by millions of his young atheist followers. But do you know who Christopher Hitchens named as his most loathsome and despicable enemy? Mother Teresa, the little saint from Calcutta. This is not a joke. Hitchens wrote an extremely rude and uncharitable book called The Missionary Position, in which he unleashed all his atheistic fury on the Catholic nun, known the world over as one of the greatest humanitarians of the 20th century. Mother Teresa, it will be recalled, founded the Missionaries of Charity, an order of sisters whose primary task is to care for the unfortunate of the world. The sisters provide assistance to the poorest of the poor in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and undertake relief work in the wake of floods, epidemics, and famines. They have houses, schools, orphanages, hospitals, and hospices in North America, Europe, and Australia, where they take care of lepers, alcoholics, the homeless, and AIDS sufferers. Mother Teresa herself chose to live and work in the dirtiest slums of India for 60 years. This humble woman, who Christopher Hitchens ridiculed as Hell's Angel, stood just under 5 feet high and devoted her whole life to serving the destitute and the dying. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979 and became a global symbol for charitable and selfless work. People of all races, religions, and nationalities recognized the goodness and kindness of this little saint. Yet to Hitchens, Mother Teresa was nothing but a quote-unquote monster. Why? Hitchens despised Mother Teresa because, as a Catholic nun, she was against divorce and abortion and artificial contraception. And in Hitchens' atheistic philosophy, these are the only effective methods of combating overpopulation and poverty. Therefore, by opposing the atheist viewpoint, Mother Teresa was guilty of insincerity and hypocrisy. Indeed, Hitchens claimed that the real reason the nun worked so tirelessly for the poor was not to help them, but rather to foster poverty, which she wanted to spread across the planet for the sole purpose of preserving the institution she had founded. According to Hitchens, that's why Mother Teresa spent thousands of hours caring for the outcasts of society. My, my. And yet, to the empty, warped, and bullying brain of the modern-day atheist, this ludicrous theory makes perfect sense. How can it be so? In an interesting article on bullying from Psychology Today, author Preston Nye writes, quote, "The most important thing to keep in mind about bullies is that they pick on those whom they perceive as weaker. So as long as you remain passive and compliant, you make yourself a target. Many bullies are also cowards on the inside," end quote. Cowards on the inside. That explains a lot. It explains, for instance, why atheists are so vocal in their criticism of committed Christians and yet so mysteriously silent when it comes to radical Muslims. Consider all the anti-Christian books that have been written by atheists in the past few years. We've only mentioned a few so far, such as God Is Not Great, The God Delusion, The End of Faith, and Letter to a Christian Nation. But there are hundreds more. For instance, American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. The Baptizing of America, The Religious Right's Plans for the Rest of Us. Atheist Universe, The Thinking Person's Answer to Christian Fundamentalism. All That's Wrong with the Bible, Contradictions, Absurdities, and More. And God Needs to Go, Why Christian Beliefs Fail. To name just a few. But where are all the atheist books warning against the dangers of Islamic fundamentalism? Where are all the atheist blogs railing against the outrages of Muslim extremists? Do atheists seriously think that Christians pose more of a threat to the United States than Islamic terrorists? Yes, it's true that some of the new atheists have been critical of Islam, especially Bill Maher, but it's a case of the exception proving the rule. After all, atheist authors have traveled all over America and Europe blasting Christian leaders and values. But how many have given the same kind of anti-God lectures in Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Egypt, and the other predominantly Islamic countries? How many of them have debated Muslim scholars in those countries? How many of them have been interviewed on Al Jazeera? These are the same pompous pundits who have described Jesus Christ and Christianity in the vilest terms imaginable. But how many of them have publicly condemned Allah or Muhammad? These are the same arrogant authors who have regularly lambasted the Christian church for its supposedly anti-woman stance. But how many of them have written scathing books about the far more oppressive anti-woman laws prevalent throughout the Muslim world? Remember, under Islamic law, a woman could be stoned to death if she's so much as accused of adultery. Yet we hardly hear a peep from atheists about such travesties of justice. Instead, they spend their time going after Mother Teresa. Best-selling author and scholar Rabbi Daniel Lappin believes that the atheist community has made a conscious choice to take this hypocritical approach in their public commentary. Quote, they sit within the comfort and safety of countries based on Christian principles and conveniently launch condemnations which are roughly quantifiable as being 90% anti-Christian and 10% anti-other religions. And this may be being too generous an estimation, end quote. But why? Why do atheists mercilessly mock Christians while at the same time ignoring the more aggressive and egregious actions of Muslims? One well-known atheist professor, in a rare moment of atheistic candor, admitted the truth. Dr. Phil Zuckerman, who teaches secular studies at Pitzer College in Claremont, California, and also writes a popular blog that criticizes Christianity and Judaism, said in a discussion on religious liberty at Georgetown University, quote, I absolutely agree that it's okay for those on the left to critique, mock, deride Christianity, but Islam gets a free pass. Which is so strange because if you care about women's rights, if you care about human rights, if you care about gay rights, then really Islam is much more problematic. Sorry to paint Islam with a huge brush. And much more devastating. What keeps me from critiquing Islam on my blog is just fear. I've got 3 kids. I know I can say anything about Christianity or Mormonism, and I'm not living in fear. End quote. As an atheist, Zuckerman continued, where on planet Earth is the death penalty meted out to atheists? It's only in 24 Muslim countries. Where have human rights flourished the most? In Christian nations, end quote. There you have it. Even though atheists are as vehemently opposed to Muslims' belief in Allah as they are to Christians' belief in Christ, they're just too scared to speak out. Atheists in Hollywood, the media, academia, and the publishing world are terrified that Islamic zealots will retaliate against them in a physical way if they say anything too harsh about the Muslim religion. So instead of voicing their objections, they attack what they consider to be a much softer and safer target, Christianity. And isn't this exactly the kind of cowardly behavior typical of bullies? Bullies never pick on anyone their own size. They always go after those whom they think will turn the other cheek. It's really quite repulsive. After all, if atheists were half as belligerent to Muslims as they are to Christians, you could at least respect them for having the courage of their convictions. But they're not. Indeed, the whole psychology of the unbeliever is built on fear. We saw in the last chapter that atheists are afraid of real arguments and instead prefer to do battle with phony straw men of their own invention. They're afraid of history and instead prefer to remain in a state of profound ignorance. They're afraid of honesty and instead resort to big lies to defame their opposition. They're afraid of democracy and instead use ruthless suppression and intimidation as a means of silencing viewpoints that are contrary to their own. Atheists are cowards through and through, inside and out. Theirs is a veritable culture of cowardice. Atheists are even afraid to face the truth about their own philosophy. They delude themselves as to what it truly means to be an atheist. They claim, for instance, that atheism has no bearing whatsoever on their moral behavior. Not only does this make no sense, but it also counters the history of atheistic thought. One has only to consult with the writings of famous atheist philosophers of the past to see how their modern counterparts have chosen a much more timid intellectual path. In fact, the atheists of the 19th century would be ashamed and even disgusted with the latest breed of unbelievers. Men like Friedrich Nietzsche, for example, understood that without God, there can be no fixed morality. Without a supreme being, there can be no supreme lawgiver, and hence, no supreme law. This was a bold, logical, and honest way of thinking, and unlike Hitchens, Dawkins, Harris, and others, the old atheists were not afraid to proclaim it. In his famous atheist treatise, Beyond Good and Evil, Nietzsche wrote, quote, severity, violence, slavery, danger in the street and in the heart, secrecy, stoicism, tempters, art, and devilry of every kind, everything wicked, terrible, tyrannical, predatory, and serpentine in man, serves as well for the elevation of the human species as its opposite. Such kind of men are we free spirits. The noble type of man regards himself as a determiner of values. He is a creator of values, end quote. That's what Nietzsche believed atheists should be. Free spirits. Spirits were really free to do whatever they wished once they had thrown off the shackles of religious oppression. In Nietzsche's philosophy, it is permissible to go beyond good and evil, because without God, there really is no such thing as good and evil. These concepts are merely human inventions. What makes something good or evil is determined solely by whether or not it serves our own personal, practical purposes. That's why Nietzsche urged his followers to become Übermensch or Superman, individuals who could understand that good and evil are simply artificial restrictions imposed by religion in order to prevent the strong from dominating the weak. Indeed, Nietzsche scorned the weak. He embraced an atheistic philosophy of social Darwinism that advocated not only survival of the fittest, but also survival of the most powerful. And why not? If God doesn't exist, how can there be any kind of objective moral law to protect the weak? How can any kind of objective moral law exist at all? Follow this point closely, because it shows why today's atheists are such intellectual cowards. We're not saying here that atheists can't be good people, or that they can't act in a morally responsible way, or that they can't act to protect the weak. Of course they can. A person doesn't have to accept the existence of God in order to be against killing or lying or cheating. But that's not the point. An atheist who says it's wrong to kill is voicing his own personal convictions and nothing more. He may find killing repugnant. He may strongly empathize with the suffering of others. He may think that for society to survive, killing must not be permitted. Christopher Hitchens, full of courageous virtue following his attacks on Mother Teresa, defended atheistic morality by saying, quote, "We know that we can't get along if we permit perjury, theft, murder, rape," end quote. Therefore, he reasoned, you can be an atheist and still be against the same crimes that believers are against. And that's right, you can. There are 100 different reasons for believing that killing is harmful or counterproductive to society. But none of these reasons are morally binding. None of them are the logical result of any existential or objective standard of morality. None show that killing is wrong in and of itself. Therefore, none can serve as a permanent basis for obligating people to obey laws against killing. This lack of moral objectivity explains why there have been so many murderous atheist regimes in the past. If an atheist leader with absolute power wants to act cruelly, he has no binding or transcendent reason not to. Without God, objective morality cannot exist. Only God, who transcends society, can say that human beings must act this way or that, or else they are breaking a law that is also transcendent. In other words, without a transcendent and almighty being, there can be no such thing as a transcendent or unbreakable law. The bottom line is that an atheist may act in a virtuous manner, but not because he must. Without God, moral precepts are simply personal codes of conduct. They're tastes or opinions, like what flavor ice cream you prefer, and not objective imperatives that are morally binding on all people. This is a logical and consistent way of thinking, and the atheists of the 19th century understood it. They were serious about their atheism. They didn't coddle and baby their followers by lying to them about the logical implications of their own philosophy. But the atheists of today don't want to admit that truth. They want to have their cake and eat it too. They go on and on about how morality can be rooted in empathy or the avoidance of suffering or the betterment of society. They go on and on about how atheism has no significant effect on moral behavior. They go on and on about how atheists are just as good and kind and law-abiding as believers. But they don't want to face up to what they really believe, that morality is ultimately relative and based on personal preferences and on expedience. They don't want to admit that atheism is therefore incapable of sustaining any kind of coherent system of morality, except one based on ruthless power. Why do atheists refuse to acknowledge these conclusions? Barry Arrington, writing in the blog Uncommon Dissent, gives the answer, quote, "because they are simpering cowards," end quote. You see, it's possible to respect a man like Nietzsche while disagreeing with his beliefs, because he at least followed his premises where they logically led him. But how can any thinking person have anything but contempt for what Arrington calls the, quote, "smiley-faced, weak-kneed, milquetoast atheism that insists that God is dead and all is well because we are just as nice as you," end quote. The truth is that Nietzsche would have spit in contempt on the atheists who are writing books and blogs today. Nietzsche was wrong in his anti-God philosophy, and in the end became an insane and tragic figure. But at least he was courageous enough to be honest. Modern atheists are not. Finally, in discussing the atheists' culture of cowardice, we can't fail to mention that atheists today are even afraid of their own human nature. Indeed, they're afraid of basic human psychology and basic human desires. This is a very profound form of cowardice, and one that requires more serious consideration. Bishop Robert Barron, whom we mentioned earlier, has given an extensive series of talks on the new atheists and has articulated this fear of human nature in the following way. Quote, "human beings have deep within them a natural desire for things like truth, love, goodness, beauty, faith, and justice. These are not material goods. They transcend the material world. They are, if you will, spiritual in nature," end quote. That's why humans are never truly satisfied with acquiring material things. Even when we have an abundance of possessions, even when we have all the pleasures that this world can offer, we still yearn for something more. This fact poses a problem for atheists. According to their materialist view of the world, human beings are merely animals. We may be more intelligent than other animals, but we're animals nonetheless. Now, animals, as a rule, are not hard to satisfy. For example, when you give a dog a big bowl of food and a big bowl of water, and you play with him for a while, and then give him a nice warm place by the fire to sleep, he's going to be fully content. He's going to be as happy as any dog in the world could be. But that's not true for human beings. If we were just dogs with bigger brains, as modern atheists claim, then we would be fully satisfied with lots of money, houses, vacations, sex, and material comforts. Like the dog by the fire, we would fall blissfully asleep once we had our fill of those things and never wish for anything more. Only we don't feel that way. In fact, it is precisely when we've experienced all the wonderful things the world has to offer that we realize more powerfully than ever before that we still lack something, that we're still hungry for something that transcends the world. In such moments, we realize that we're not just highly intelligent animals, but rather we possess some kind of mysteriously spiritual component as well. To those who believe in God, these transcendent desires don't pose any problem. Indeed, they make perfect sense. As C.S. Lewis said, "the hunger we have for truth, goodness, beauty, etc., is really a hunger for God himself. They are just different aspects of God. They are reflections of him from different angles, and the yearning we have for them was put there by our Creator for a reason, so that we would seek him. Indeed, God is the fuel we were built to run on." Or as St. Augustine succinctly summarized, "our hearts are restless until they rest in God." The Bible is full of stories about kings who became rich and mighty, yet failed to achieve happiness. As the book of Ecclesiastes famously says, all is vanity. According to believers, what God is trying to teach us in these stories is that the solution to the riddle of human happiness is not to seek more riches, but rather to change our priorities and reorder our lives so that the transcendent spiritual values come first. Truth, love, goodness, beauty, faith, and justice must come before money, sex, power, prestige, possessions, and honor. In other words, God must come first and everything else after. That is the proper perspective for a well-ordered and happy human being. And while these desires can never be completely satisfied in this life, human beings can at least look forward to full union with God in heaven, when we will finally be able to enjoy perfect happiness. Therefore, despite any suffering we encounter in life, we can always have hope for the future. Naturally, those who don't believe in God reject this way of thinking. But they have a problem on their hands. If there is no God and no spiritual reality, what are these transcendent desires? Where do they come from? Why do we have them? Even more importantly, what does their existence mean for us? What are their implications for our happiness? And here is where the modern atheists show once again how cowardly they are. Here is where they show how greatly inferior they are to the unbelievers of the past. The older brand of atheists, especially existentialists like Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, understood that human beings have deep, inborn desires that cannot be satisfied by anything in this world. They recognized that an inherent tension exists between the desire we have for transcendence, for God in some form, and the fact, in their judgment, that God does not exist. They concluded that because of this paradox, life is tragic. Indeed, life is an absurdity. After all, what's the point of having desires if they can't ever be fulfilled? In order to deal with this paradox of absurdity, their solution was to say that human beings needed to boldly assert the power of their own will. Basically, human beings needed to fully recognize and accept the futility, tragedy, and meaninglessness of life, and push on anyway, like some stoic Hemingway hero. Like Nietzsche before them, these existentialist atheists were wrong in their thinking, but at least brave in their approach to life. They tried to accept the implications of their belief, no matter how grim those implications might be. They were serious about their atheism, not frivolous, like today's smiley-faced, weak-kneed, milquetoast unbelievers. They were tough enough to admit that human beings do have a yearning for the transcendent, and that this desire creates a problem for atheists, a problem that requires a courageous philosophy in response. The atheists of today, however, do not admit there's a problem. They don't admit human beings have transcendent desires at all. Materialist to the core, they deny any kind of spiritual reality. Instead, they believe the silliness that says science has all the answers, that our deepest longings for love and friendship and beauty and honor and hope and home and eternal life are really just the result of a meaningless movement of molecules. As Bishop Barron has said, religion has been accused of being the opiate of the masses, but in reality, it is modern atheism that offers a hallucinogenic drug to its followers. A drug that masks the desires we all have deep within us for something more. You really don't have those desires, the atheists whisper over and over. Just relax and enjoy life. There's nothing more than this world. God is an illusion. There's no need to look into yourself and ask difficult existential questions about the spiritual meaning of being. The only thing that counts is science. The only thing that matters is matter. Even in the face of all the millionaires, movie stars, and music industry celebrities who are so desperately unhappy despite their wealth and worldly fame, these new atheists persist in living in denial. They're just too afraid to face facts about human nature. They're too afraid to be honest about what the human heart really needs to be fulfilled. Atheists have always claimed that believers are afraid of death. But the truth is, atheists are afraid of life. In the next chapter, we'll see just how far they take this fear of life. For, like everything else they touch, they're not happy unless they distort even this simple emotion into something dark and twisted. Not content to merely be afraid and leave the rest of us alone, atheists have taken